All right, people, let's start. And I'm gonna share my screen, and we'll get going. And I have a little exercise from the very beginning here. So we're on Gideon Abimelech. If it's August the 3rd, that's what we're supposed to study. So that's what we'll do. Let me just re-expand my window here now that I've shared the screen. Thank you all for coming. We have a lot to cover. I'm going to try to fast forward through some of the parts of the story that I think we know pretty well, like the 300 men with the torches and pitchers, if that's okay. I think we know those pretty well. There'll be an opportunity to make a point or two if you want to when we cover it. But let's. There's a little bit of So I've got to start by saying where we are in the. Remember, we began with judges that were pretty good. That was Deborah, all the way up to Deborah and Barak. And now we're starting on the okay judges. That would be Gideon. And we'll see some things about Gideon that were not the most admirable. But, of course, what led to what later led to big problems was what happened after he was victorious. So this is all of tonight's lesson in these four chapters, 6 through 9. Okay. I wanted to try to remember some of the important Hebrew words. So if everybody wants to go off mute and just shout out what these words mean, the faster the better. I'm sure you know what these are. So let's start with El. What's El?
El.
Oh, this is not fast enough. We got to go faster.
God.
Yes, thank you. Yahweh.
Jehovah.
Yes, personal name of God. Adonai.
Lord.
Lord. Yes.
Baal.
Also Lord.
Yeah, it's kind of Lord, husband, master. But it really means a deity when it's used generally. Ben?
Son.
Son. Benjamin?
Son of my right hand.
My right hand. Beer or beer?
Well.
Yes, thank you. Beth?
House.
Beth El?
House of God.
Bethlehem?
House of bread.
House of bread. That's where Ruth had to leave because there wasn't bread. Not Ruth, Naomi, I mean. Shalom, Salem, Shiloh, those peace. Words, yeah, all related to peace. They're red because they're going to show up tonight. It'll be handy that we know these words. Abi?
My father.
Yes. And I think that's, I guess if you were a baby, you instead of saying daddy, you'd say dada. And so instead of Abi, you might say Abba. And so Abba, father, maybe is a relationship with those words. Melech or Melki?
King.
Yeah, and now, you notice these two words go together tonight, right? Abi Melech, what would that mean?
My father is king.
Yeah, or something like that. Father king, or my father is king, or something. Negev?
South.
South. Gilgal?
Remove.
Move.
Nope.
Rolling.
Rolling.
Bochum?
Weeping.
Yeah, weepers, and notice weepers. The IM. Remember what does IM usually mean?
Plural.
Plural, yeah. And even up here on Elohim, on El, it's plural. And then, so that's at Havoth. These are, we haven't really covered those. We'll get to them. But these are two similar words, villages or city, right? Village or city. Havoth, Jer, the Kiriath, Jerim, the city of Jerim. And then Jerubbaal, one of our words for tonight.
Contend with.
Yes, let Baal contend is one translation. Yes, something like that. And you don't know this, so I'll just tell you. Berith means covenant. And it's a kind of a related the word for cutting or whatever. But Berith is going to come up tonight because we'll see a place called Baal Berith. And what do you think that would mean? Baal Berith. It's Baal of the covenant. That's not too hard. But anyway, just watch for that. That's just a little bit of background. More background we need to know and remember. And I'm sorry for so much review, but I forget from week to week, so it helps me. Where would you put Judah on this map?
South Beersheba.
Yeah. You could name some cities that are in it. Obviously, Bethlehem and Hebron, which is the tomb of the patriarchs. Abraham, Sarah are buried there. I think Jacob as well. And so that's Judah. And what brother of Judah is absorbed into Judah?
Simeon,
and we covered that in the first chapter. Judah and Simeon went up together in their battle. Okay, then if you go farther north, Jerusalem is on the border with what tribe?
Benjamin.
Benjamin, and that's kind of has a political significance when David moves his reign, you know. And then beside Benjamin, who's that? With in the Philistine territory, yeah, those Ashdod, Ekron, Gath, Gaza, those are Philistine capitals. But remember, Dan also showed up because we'll learn later in the book because they couldn't find a good place, peaceful place to live, so they had to go boot some people out way up in the north. All right, what's the tribe just north of Benjamin?
Ephraim.
Yes, it's often called the what country?
Hill country.
All right, we often call it the Pill country, remember, because they're obstinate and rebellious and jealous, and we're going to start to see that develop more in the lesson tonight. Now, there's the tribe above is quite large in land area and has an east and a west. What's that area right in here?
Manasseh.
Right. I want you to notice Shechem while we're looking at the chart. Shechem shows up predominantly in this lesson in chapter 9. And so just like Jerusalem is on the border of Judah and Benjamin, Bethel on the border of Benjamin and Ephraim, Shechem is on the border, but it's in Ephraim, actually. And so the little town of Ophrah, we don't know where it is, somewhere around in here, is in Manasseh. And so western Manasseh is there and eastern Manasseh is there. What are the other two Transjordan tribes?
Sakkar.
Reuben and Gad.
Reuben and Gad, thank you. Good.
Oh, Reuben and Gad, okay.
Yeah, and then if you keep on going up, what's the area where chariots work real well?
Sakkar.
That's close.
Issachar,
yes, that's
okay.
Right.
Issachar.
And then one you just have to remember, maybe somebody can help me with is Zebulun. And then who's by the sea?
Asher,
good. And Asher kind of stayed by their seashore last week, but this week they're going to come in and help. So we'll see them show up this time, not unlike last time. And then what's this long tribe here that incorporates Hazor? We studied it last week.
Naphtali or something.
Yeah, Naphtali or Naphtali, however you want to say
Naphtali.
It. That's right. That's good. Okay. All right. Let's start with Judges 6. Just dive right in. And again, it's a good bit of reading. I've not put all the text in, so you can look forward to a little bit of fast forward. But please stop me if you see an interesting point or a question or and then I'll just reflect the question to somebody else on the call. No, I'll try to answer it. The children of Israel, verse 6, remember we just finished the poem of Deborah and Barak, and the sun is coming out at the end of chapter 5. And leaders have come forth, they've done what they should do, and really things are breaking forth in the kind of an optimistic picture. Then the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. Have we seen that before, this cycle, right? So it's not a surprise. So the Lord, remember the Lord is Jehovah, and this is the New King James, but the all caps mean it's that Yahweh word, delivered them into the hand of Midian for 7 years, and the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel. And because of the Midianites, the children of Israel made for themselves dens, caves, strongholds, which are in the mountains. So it was whenever Israel had sown, Midian would come up, also Amalekites and the people of the East would come up against them. They would encamp against them and destroy the produce of the earth as far as Gaza and leave no sustenance for Israel, neither sheep nor ox nor donkey. They would come up with their livestock and their tents, coming in as numerous as locusts. Both they and their camels were without number. They would enter the land, destroy it. So Israel was greatly impoverished because of the Midianites, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. So do you get the sense that this was a seasonal oppression? And what season would they show up in?
Harvest.
At the harvest, that's right. Looks like they not only did that, but then they just destroy whatever was left that they couldn't carry off. So it wasn't just taking their stuff. It was actually a good bit of oppression. The result, and we saw a hint of that in the Song of Deborah, is you just couldn't really live in the civilized areas. You had to go live in a den or a cave because if you lived out in the open there, you'd be oppressed when they came in every year around harvest time. Verse 7, it came to pass when the children of Israel cried out to the Lord because of the Midianites. Now, we might have expected here the text to say that God raised up a judge and delivered them. Well, that's going to happen eventually. But what does God actually do first here? This is a little different. Is it? Well, we should read it, I guess.
He sends a prophet.
Yeah, and he sent a prophet to the children of Israel who said to them, Thus says the Lord God of Israel, I brought you up from Egypt. I brought you out of the house of bondage. I delivered you out of the land, hand of the Egyptians, out of the hand of all who oppress you. By the way, does that sound familiar, all these words that the prophet is saying here? Have you heard that kind of language before? Like over and over, you could start with Moses as he was dying. You could go back to the second chapter of this book, verses 1 through 5, and that's what the angel said when he came up from Gilgal to Bochim. Remember that? The angel who came from the rolling of the curse to the weepers. It's almost the same word-for-word speech about delivering from Egypt. And I am the Lord your God. Do not fear the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But you have not obeyed my voice. So that was kind of the message of the prophet. And so the next scene we have after this prophet is you've got Gideon. You know the story, I think. I won't spend a lot of time. But Gideon is down. I say down. I assume it was into the ground a little bit. But it was in a wine press, which I picture being dug into the ground with maybe some walls, stone, or maybe even wood, in which you put the grapes and you'd stomp them or smash them or do something in so that the juice would come out. I guess that's what it was for. But something strange is happening. The angel of the Lord came and sat under the terebinth tree, which was in Ophrah, which belonged to Joash, the Abiezrite. We learned later, just not too much later, that that's Manasseh. That's the tribe of Manasseh. So probably a little town a few miles north, probably, and maybe northwest of Shechem, which we'll talk about in just a minute. While his son Gideon threshed wheat in the winepress in order to hide it from the Midianites. Now we know why he was down in there. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him and said, "The Lord is with you, you mighty man of valor." Now, does Gideon look like a mighty man of valor at this point? Not nearly. He's hiding in the winepress. And a little bit like Deborah, who says to Barak, "Has not the Lord commanded you?" As if he already ought to know what he was supposed to do. In this case, now he may have had a history of some degree of valor. That's a possibility. But I have an idea that God looks at us in terms of what we could be, right? And what our potential is and being able to see the end from the beginning. He tells Gideon what he actually is. And now you'll notice, in fact, I think I'm going to skip this part of the text, and I've just put it in bullet form, and it kind of helps me see the back and forth. So the angel appears while he's threshing wheat. Jehovah, now the language changes from saying the angel said this to Jehovah says it. I don't know quite what to make of that. I know we've seen the angel of the Lord before. Remember in chapter 2 when he came from Gilgal to Bochim, and we think it might be the same angel of the commanders of the Lord's army that Joshua had experience with in Gilgal. But anyway, the angel comes. But it seems like the language shifts between Jehovah saying these things to Gideon and the angel. But anyway, Jehovah tells him that the Lord is with him. Verse 12, we just read that. And Gideon says, no, he's not. He's forsaken us, and he kind of points to the national situation. And then Jehovah commands Gideon to save Israel from the Midianites. It's like, I'm not listening to you. You go do your job. And Gideon objects, and he says, I'm the least, and he says, I'm the least in the city. And, of course, he at that point, he mentions the Manasseh connection. And then Jehovah assures Gideon that he will be with him. And Gideon asks for a sign. And the angel said, okay, and he runs to get some meat and some bread, and he puts it on a rock, and the angel burns it up, or the rock, fire comes out of the rock. The angel disappears somehow, but the voice of God doesn't disappear. That's interesting to me, is the angel disappears after that sign of the burning meal, and I burn my meals quite often, but not the way this happened. I did that yesterday, as a matter of fact. But anyway, Gideon's frightened, a little bit like we'll see later Manoah, Samson's dad and mom, mainly Manoah. His mom kind of calms him down, but he's frightened because he's seen the angel. And again, Jehovah tells him he won't die. He builds an altar to Jehovah, and then Jehovah commands Gideon to tear down the Baal altar in his house. Do you see in this back and forth a kind of a pattern? I kind of tried to put it in this bullet form. What kind of a pattern do you see going on here? In this, it's not quite a dialogue, but sequences of events.
Some faith and no faith.
Yeah, it's like it's almost like Gideon keeps trying not to cooperate or not to believe or to have doubts or to struggle or think he's going to die or something. And every time God keeps coming back and saying what needs to be said. You see that? I can never find, there it is. So you notice the angel of the Lord, then Gideon, then Jehovah, then Gideon, then Jehovah, then Gideon, then the angel, then Gideon, Jehovah, Gideon. You see this back and forth through this whole time. And if you look at the theme, you see Gideon's like the reluctant, kind of doubtful kind of a person. But God keeps at him, keeps telling him, you got to do it. I'm commanding you to do this. And what's interesting is when Gideon seems to be convinced and he builds this altar to Jehovah, the next thing is not go call all the men to battle. It's go fix your own house. Y'all know what I mean by that. That is, you got an altar of Baal right in your own home, in your father's house. And so Gideon obeys, but he does it at night. And the text explains why he does it at night. Why does he do it at night?
He's afraid of his father's house.
Again, another courageous move on part of Gideon. He's kind of afraid, and probably with good reason. We learned that the men of the city demand that he be executed, and to his credit, Joash, the father, stands up, defends Gideon, and says, you know what, if Baal is a real god, he'll take care of this himself, so y'all just wait and see what happens. And so from then on, Gideon had a new name. It was Jerubbaal, which is, let's just wait and see if Baal contends. Not all those words, but anyway, you get the idea. Let's just keep going.
I have a question.
Yeah, Ryan.
So when Gideon says that, you know, Jehovah has forsaken us, is there, like, do you think there's no understanding that you're serving, you know, idols and foreign gods? Of course, God is not going to fight for you. Like, it just seems almost like there's this cluelessness going on.
I know. And it's emphasized because it follows immediately after the prophet's explaining everything. You know what I mean? Now, did Gideon listen to the prophet? I don't know. That's a very good point. I think I've seen folks, and maybe I've been in this situation, where I get myself in a mess and it's all my fault, but it's to blame God and say, how'd you let this happen, you know? But I think that might be kind of the idea. I don't know. Any other comments on that?
I have a comment, Marty. When in Hebrews 11, when the judges are mentioned, Gideon goes at the top. I mean, at the first.
Yeah, I'd like to make a point about that since you brought it up, if I can bring up my pen here. In the book of Hebrews, chapter 11, I think I've mentioned this several times before, but there's an order, and time will fail to tell of. And what's the order? Can anybody quote that verse? It's time will fail to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, and Jephthah, David, and Samuel, and then the prophets down here, right? Those are the prophets, all right? Now, Gideon, is he, who comes first in the book of Judges, Gideon or Barak?
Barak.
Yeah, so those are reversed in order, aren't they? And who comes first, Samson or Jephthah?
Jephthah.
Yeah, so they're reversed in order, right? And so what you have, and who comes first, David, sorry, my D's sloppy here, or Samuel? Who's first in the?
Samuel.
Samuel is. You see a pattern there. So it's almost like the Hebrew writer is grouping these together. And when we look at Gideon and Barak, do we see something in common and maybe even see the opposite in common with Samson and Jephthah in these stories?
Reluctance.
Yes, fearfulness. And we're studying that right this second. We're reading about that. And Barak the same way, who was afraid to go unless Deborah went with him. And she seems to have been, you know, pushing him to do the thing all along. And on the other hand, I think we find very confident men, perhaps to a fault in the course in the case of Samson, in Jephthah and Samson that are grouped together. And then David and Samuel grouped together and, you know, in reverse order, but obviously tied together in history very well. So, yeah, thanks for that point. All right, let's go ahead.
Marty, can I slow you down since you were making some good points? Sorry. I just was thinking, you know, from yesterday's class on Romans, talking about that faith to faith from beginning to end.
Yeah.
And, you know, you think of Abraham, but I mean, Gideon too. It took time. I mean, it took a lot of evidence actually for him to build that faith to go in with 300 men.
Yeah. I'm going to fast forward through part of that, but you know how the story progresses. We haven't even got to the fleece and the dew yet. We haven't got to the dream in the camp of the Midianites yet, but why are all these things required? Well, it's because Gideon has doubts, right? And he's needing some reassurance, right? So all the Midianites and Amalekites, people of the east, gathered together and they crossed over and encamped in the Valley of Jezreel. Do you understand the significance of that is, uh-oh, it's harvest time. Here they are. I guess it's one thing in the abstract when God says you're going to deliver the Israelites when there are no Midianites around, but now they've come. You see the significance of that. Now he's got to step up to what God is asking to do. But verse 34, a phrase we've been looking for, and we found it some, and we haven't found it in other places, but the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon, right? Mm-hmm. Who else did the Spirit of the Lord come upon that you can remember?
Samson.
Elisha.
Well, I'm talking about so far in our study of the book of Judges.
Oh.
So the Spirit came upon Othniel, remember that? But not upon Ehud, interestingly enough. And I'm not sure what all to make of that. I think in the case of Barak, it doesn't say that, but he had an inspired woman, you know, pushing him, telling him what to do. So that might count. But here the Spirit of the Lord comes upon Gideon. And it, you might think then he goes in like Shamgar and slays a bunch of people. But no, I guess it required that for him to have the courage to blow the trumpet. And so that he could gather people from Manasseh, the Abiezrites. He sent messengers throughout all Manasseh. And he sent messengers to Asher and to Zebulun and Naphtali. And you remember where they, those were on the map. They're neighbors to the north. And so they came up to meet him. Notice what tribe is not mentioned there that will come up later in the story.
Ephraim.
Neighbors to the south. Not nation, but tribe to the south. Ephraim, the pill country of Ephraim. And we've seen Ephraim a couple of times already. And it seems like in Ehud's case and in they actually volunteered and came up and fought. I believe they were the ones with the experience against the Amalekites. They fought with Barak. We remember Ehud called them to take the fords of the Jordan, and they were good against the Moabites. But anyway, and Gideon said to God, if you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said, look, I will put a fleece of wool on the threshing floor. If there's dew on the fleece only, and it's dry on all the ground, I'll know that you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said. And it was so. Now, I don't know if you've experimented much with dew, but what's the normal way that that would happen? Do anybody know?
Would the dew way that normally, the way it happened.
Pardon, David, what?
Pretty much the way it happened, right? It evaporated off the grass first, and the fleece would absorb the water and be the last to dry.
I guess that's right. But, you know, I think if I had asked for that experiment at the end, I would say, no, wait, is that normal or not? Because I don't know. So the only way to test that, whether it was a normal thing or not, is he wrung out the dew, a dope bowlful, but he said, look, can we just do this again? And like a good scientist, he did a controlled experiment and he reversed the variables to see how it would come out on the other side. In verse 40, and God did so that night. It was dry on the fleece only, but there was dew on the ground. So again, a strange request. God did not seem to object to it. I suppose if we know our hearts and God knows our hearts and we really do need help with our faith and we're trying our best, that he will give us an answer. But I can't help but be reminded of times when the Jews were asking Jesus for a sign. And he didn't accommodate them. And I think it had to do with the condition of their hearts. But here God helps Gideon with his faith. And this not the last time he does. It's going to happen some more. So I'm going to fast forward through the battle. I think every kid has studied this. Every one of the picture books that I read to my grandkids have this story in it. Gideon gathered his army, 32,000 of them, by Morah. And that's near Mount Gilboa, probably. This is Gilead in the text. And it's by the Herod Springs. I meant to put the picture. I have a picture of Daniel and Beth drinking like this at the Herod Springs when we went to Israel. But anyway, it's pretty much of a public a park, you know, beautifully landscaped now, and probably not like it was then. Jehovah tells the fearful to return. Tells Gideon to tell the fearful to return. And so 22,000 of them did. So that's almost more than two out of every three. And that's consistent with the law. Deuteronomy 28 says, if you're fearful, don't hang around. Don't go to battle. Go back home. And because you're lacking faith. So that happened. And then there was a drinking test. I don't know exactly how to describe it. A lapping test, a scooping test, something. So all but 300 of those failed. And there's all kind of fanciful explanations, right? The ones that smash their face down into the water, one theory is that there was just so used to worshiping Baal, they were on their knees all the time. So that's, he wanted them out of there. I don't think that's true. But anyway, those are some theories. Or if you cup your hands, that means you're a good warrior because you're always looking around. But anyway, whatever. But he got down to 300. But the interesting thing was, as the others departed, and whatever 10,000 minus 300 is, when they were leaving, they left their trumpets with them. I wonder why. And so apparently there were about 300 trumpets around that those maybe 32,000 people. But they all would have a trumpet. Interesting. And I wonder if they didn't also get pitchers and torches at the same time. But anyway, it's the night before, the night of the battle. And so Jehovah tells Gideon to go down the camp if he's afraid. And so it says right away in the text, so he went down. So we know he's still wrestling with his fears, and I'm with him on that. You know, there are things you know you're going to do. There are things that you maybe dreaded, but you still are afraid. And someone has said courage is not being afraid, but, you know, overcoming those to do the right thing. Anyway, he hears a Midianite's dream about a barley loaf that knocks a tent over. And so for some reason, that's all he needed. You notice a kind of this progression of the signs here. The first one is like fire comes up and burns up a meal, right? That's pretty impressive. The next one is just dew overnight. Is this a real impressive miracle here? I mean, he hears a dream and then the guy interprets it for him. May not even be a miracle. You know what I mean? But it's somehow enough. It's just enough for him to do it. And so he immediately goes back and he says, okay, we're ready. We're going to do it. And so he tells everybody the plan, which is to, I guess, to use the pitcher to hide the torch and then blow the trumpet when they hear him blow the trumpet. And they divide into three groups and they surround the whole camp out on the plain. And they wait, I think, till the watch changes, which is probably everybody's deep asleep. And all this noise, the trumpets and the lights show up all around them in these torches. And you must assume that there's one torch for every, you know, 100,000 soldiers and one trumpet for every 10,000 soldiers. Who knows? And so they apparently just thought they were under attack. And so they were routed and they just took off running toward the Jordan. I think I put a map in here. Yeah. So you can see, there we go, right here. So you can see this is Herod's well. This is kind of where they encircle the enemy by somebody's imagination. So immediately they take off, apparently in two groups. And so there's the Ziba and Zalmunna are probably stayed with the main body. And then the other two, what were their names that the Ephraimites ended up killing? We'll get to it anyway. The two Z's, I think, were with the main body. But the first
group. Oreb and Zeeb, yeah.
Oreb and Zeeb, right. They take off. They're apparently faster. They've got maybe armed men or something. So they get ahead of the group and they run down the Jordan, I guess, looking for a handy place to go across, go as far as they can. And the other group is slower and Gideon and his 300 men are chasing them. Okay. So then they're going to end up going this way across the Jordan. And the first group, Oreb and Zeeb, they're going to show up here and that's when the Ephraimites will come and get them. So you kind of get the picture there. Again, this flat area of Issachar, here's Manasseh, here's Ephraim. So you kind of get the scene here for where that's supposed to go. So Gideon calls Ephraim to seize the fords of the Jordan, and the Ephraimites kill Oreb and Zeeb and brought their heads to Gideon. So that's the rest of chapter 7. But then one little postscript to the battle, which does not bode well. Remember, we've seen Ephraim willingly, quickly, heroically came to the aid of Ehud and the Moabites. They were apparently front of the line in helping Barak and against the Canaanites. But now they still did a good job, you might say. But the men of Ephraim said to Gideon, why have you done this to us? Had he done something to them? By not calling us when you went to fight with the Midianites. And they reprimanded him sharply. So he said to them, what have I done now in comparison with you? Now, this is Gideon kind of working his way out of this with some fancy word work, you know, footwork there. Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? God has delivered into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb, and Zeeb. What was I able to do in comparison with you? Of course, at this point, he had not caught up with Zeeb and Zalmunna, who were like, seemed like the bigger leaders of the whole group. And so he was still in chasing them. But apparently that calmed them down. Now, I want you to remember that because we're going to get to the story of Jephthah. And again, Ephraim shows up as troublesome. Actually, before we get to Jephthah, we're going to see in this lesson that they show up as troublesome. But by the time they get to Jephthah, their languages are different enough that they can tell who's an Ephraimite just by the way they pronounce some words. And so you see a kind of a cultural separation here now. You're seeing a really a great divide. They're not unified as a nation, not in their language, but certainly in the way they work together and cooperate. Rather than rejoicing with Gideon in his victory, they're angry somehow because they weren't invited to the battle. Although they had been, they might have drunk the water wrong and been sent home. You never know. But anyway. Okay, so Gideon came to the Jordan. He and the 300 men who were with him, they crossed over exhausted but still in pursuit. And he said to the men of Succoth, an Israelite town, friends Jordan, in the area of, what's that region over there? It's not a tribe, but that whole area, it's called?
Gilead.
Gilead, yeah. He says, please give loaves of bread to the people who follow me, for they're exhausted. I'm pursuing Zeeb and Zalmunna, kings of Midian. And the leaders of Succoth said, are the hands of Zeeb and Zalmunna now in your hand that we should give bread to your army? Almost like you have to have proven you've beaten them before we would support you. So Gideon said, for this cause, when the Lord has delivered Zeeb and Zalmunna into my hand, I will tear your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars. And then the same thing happened at this Penuel town, except in this case, he saw the tower and he says, okay, in this case, I'm going to just tear your tower down, which is maybe that was going to be their punishment. Anyway, so Zeeb and Zalmunna were at Karkor, their armies with them, 15,000, all of who were left, all that were left of the army of the people of the east, for 120,000 men who drew the sword had fallen. Gideon went by the road of those who dwell in tents on the east of Noba and Jogbeha, or whatever that, how you say that. And he attacked the army while the camp felt secure. Do you see a difference in Gideon's approach here? Is he outnumbered? And he's on their home territory. He's not even on his home field, you know. And he doesn't wait to draw them out, which we'll see later in the story as Abimelech's trick, you know. But he just charges them, and he wins. And he took the two kings, Zeeb and Zalmunna, and he routed the whole army. So there's a little bit more to the story of Zeeb and Zalmunna. But anyway, I feel like I want to skip these verses, but I almost don't want to. Also, maybe I won't. I want to ask you a question. I'm going to ask you, was Gideon right to do what he did in these verses 13 through 18 or 13 through 17? Well, actually, on ahead. That's Gideon, son of Joash, returned from battle, from the ascent of Heres, and he caught a young man of the men of Succoth and interrogated him. And this man, young man, apparently wrote down for Gideon the leaders of Succoth and his elders, 77 men, and he came to the men of Succoth and said, here are Zeeb and Zalmunna, about whom you ridiculed me, saying, are they in your hands? We should give bread to your weary men. And he took the elders of the city, the thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them he taught the men of Succoth. I wonder what he taught them. Anyway, then he tore down the tower of Penuel, and he killed the men of the city, so he even went beyond that. So do you see, are these Israelites? I think so. Sewell, are you shaking your head? No, do you think they might not be? No, sorry. Off mute. You have to go off mute.
Okay. All I have to say, I don't know.
Yeah. Okay.
I didn't realize they were. I hadn't thought about that being true. I didn't think of them as being Israelites, but perhaps they were.
Yeah, so I just assumed they were. I hadn't thought about them not being Israelites, so maybe we both should look into it and maybe study some more. But I do think that you remember a story back in the first chapter, I think it was, about what was his name? Adonai Bezek, I think. The thumbs and toes story. Remember that? Mm-hmm. It just feels to me like that the Israelites are looking more and more like, you know, the way the world acts in terms of how they take vengeance, about how they think they're gaining respect by people by, you know, promising vengeance and coming back and keeping their word and all that kind of thing. Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but we certainly will see that with Abimelech, okay? You can't see it in Gideon. It just hits you in the face with Abimelech, how he rules and the way he handles basically his enemies and even his brothers, as a matter of fact. Meanwhile, Gideon interrogates these two kings or leaders, Zeba and Zalmunna, and apparently there was some incident. It may have been before any of this happened. I don't know. But there was these, some men were killed at Tabor, and I'm guessing, remember, Tabor's out on that same plain, just on the northern end, and I'm guessing that Gideon must have lost his brothers, and to the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna, and he was wondering if he could find out who killed them. Does anybody have a better model of that? That's my understanding of what's happening here. It's not recorded. I don't think they died in the battle or anything like that, but apparently at some other time, maybe the previous season or maybe shortly before the battle, he had lost his brothers to these raiding armies. And they said, yeah, as you are, so were they. Each one resembled the son of a king. I won't stop at that, but anyway. And he said, they were my brothers, the sons of my mother. As the Lord lives, if you had let them live, I would not kill you. And so he gets his firstborn son, which I assume is one of the 70 sons that he eventually ends up with. Remember that? We're going to read later that he had 70 sons and lots of wives. I guess that's good that one woman didn't have to have all 70 of them. That doesn't probably justify the polygamy, but at least it makes it easier to have 70 sons. Anyway, he tells Jether to rise and kill them, but the youth wouldn't draw his sword. He was afraid. That's an interesting theme, isn't it? A son of Gideon afraid? How could that be? Basically, Zeba and Zalmunna, again, I think in typical pagan fashion, said, you do it. You know, remember we've seen a similar situation earlier. We're going to see one later too about some strange sense of honor. For as a man is, so is his strength. So Gideon arose and killed Zeba and Zalmunna and took the crescent ornaments that were on their camels' necks. Okay. Let's go ahead to the next one. And this is interesting. The men of Israel said to Gideon, rule over us, both you and your son and your grandson. So they were going to set up a dynasty. For you have delivered us from the hand of Midian. You know, this reminds me of when you guys were recruiting me to teach this class. And I was thinking, no, I don't think so. Let's don't do that. He didn't do it, to his credit, perhaps. He said, I will not rule over you, nor shall my son. The Lord shall rule over you. Doesn't that sound interesting? It's the theme in reverse, really, of the book of Judges about there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. I think that's just a great statement. But he did say, okay, but just one thing. I'd like you to give me all the earrings from the plunder. And apparently it was a lot, just tons of it. I mean, not maybe quite literally tons, but pounds and pounds of it. And somehow or another, if you were reading this as an Israelite, maybe in the time of Samuel, when it seemed to have been written, you would know, oh, Ishmaelites, yeah, they're really into jewelry. And so there must have been a lot of gold that they, to bling, you know, that they could melt down. So they answered, we'll gladly give them. They spread out a garment. Each man threw into the earrings from his plunder. The weight of the gold was 1,700 shekels of gold, besides the crescent of ornaments, pendants, purple robes, which are on the kings of Midian, besides the chains that were around the camels' necks. Yeah, they were into the bling, weren't they? Then Gideon made an ephod and set it up in the city, Ophrah. Please remember that. So Israel played the harlot, which is a kind of a euphemism for the actual Hebrew there. It'd probably be stronger language if it were translated literally, but with this ephod. I'm not sure, but I think that they were actually thinking they were worshiping Jehovah, but they did it using this ephod as kind of a symbol, perhaps, of the power of Gideon, you know, or the victory over the Midianites or something like that. Anybody have any other ideas about that? Because I think we're going to see later that this worship of this ephod in Ophrah is set up as a comparison against the Baal Berith temple in Shechem. So just keep that in mind. So imagine now, Ophrah is in what tribe again? Anybody remember? Gideon's tribe.
Manasseh.
Good, thank you. And Shechem, we'll see, is going to be in Ephraim, just over the border. So two kind of temples, to some extent, in competition.
Marty, I have a question.
Yes.
Is it later on when with Gideon's response to that he's not going to rule over them, when they started talking about grapes and he's going to have these, I don't know if you know, okay, they're going to start talking about these. Is that according to his response? Is that because of his response?
No, I don't think so. I think the story about the olive tree and the fig tree and the vine, the grapevine, mm-hmm. are that's a story that one of his sons, Jotham, is going to tell to the men of Shechem who apparently wanted to anoint Abimelech to be their king. We'll get to that in a minute. But it certainly is the opposite of Gideon, isn't it? Abimelech wanting to be king, campaigning, paying off men to help him. I mean, you'll see all that. His ambition was a great contrast to Gideon. I want you to notice, up to this point, we remember that Gideon had been named Jerubbaal after he had torn down the altar in his father's house. Have you noticed the use of that term through all the battle and everything? Have you noticed? Has he been called Jerubbaal?
No.
Right? You see that? All through the story of the battle, he's not really called that. And then all of a sudden, in the story then about Abimelech, the title of Gideon shifts. You notice that? He actually has it here as Gideon, but really he begins to be called Jerubbaal, and you'll see the name now almost consistently appears as Jerubbaal. I wonder why that is. I don't know if you have any ideas about that, but I'm going to propose a few in just a minute. I shouldn't have said that. I think you'd be more creative if you didn't think I knew the answer, maybe. I don't know. But anyway, so Jerubbaal, the son of Joash, went and dwelt in his own house in Ophrah, remember, in Manasseh. Gideon had 70 sons who were his own offspring, for he had many wives. And his concubine, who was in Shechem, bore him a son whose name he called Abimelech. Now that in the Hebrew, that's an awkward way of saying that was his name. It's probably the case that it wasn't his name, but that rather he took it or wanted to be called as something like my father is king or something like that, which is really not true. But in some ways, it enables him to take to some extent to tie himself to Gideon's pseudo royalty, you know, at least his fame, I think. I don't know, but that's Abimelech. But anyway, we'll call him that, even though that might not have been his actual name. He was called that. Anyway, Gideon died at a good old age and was buried in the tomb of Joash's father in Ophrah of the Abiezrites in Manasseh. Okay. So it was, as soon as Gideon was dead, the children of Israel played the harlot with their Baals and made Baal Berith their god. You remember what Baal Berith stands for? We studied the very beginning. What's Berith? I can tell I didn't reinforce that well. It's covenant, okay? It's the word for covenant. So it's the Baal of the covenant. And keep that in your head. We're going to try to puzzle over that. Thus the children of Israel did not remember the Lord their God, who had delivered them from the hands of their enemies, all their enemies on every side, nor did they show kindness to the house of Jerubbaal, unless we forget, that's Gideon, in accordance with the good he had done for Israel. Okay? Now, it's time for a break. Okay? I would like to propose a contest. So let me, I'm going to stop sharing my screen. And I'm going to break everybody into groups here. And I think we'll have, let's say, 22 participants. I think maybe four rooms would be just perfect. So some of the groups will have maybe five or six people. Here's the contest. It's timed, all right? And there is no prize, but there's a great deal of honor at the end for whichever team wins, okay? Here's the contest. I'm going to give you maybe 5 minutes. And I would like you to find list as many things as you can find about the city of Shechem in the whole Bible, beginning to end. All right? Is everybody ready? And you can use any tools at your disposal. All right? Don't log off to get on Google, but if you can get on Google without logging off, that'd be fine too. Is everybody ready? List everything you can remember or find about the city of Shechem. And remember, what tribe is it in?
Ephraim,
thank you. It's on the town of the border. All right, ready, set, go. Check them and open them. Okay, that's good. Okay, so I'm good to go. All right, before I share my screen, let's hear some of what you got. How about if you know what your group number was? Group one.
One or four? I think four.
Yeah, let me bring up the groups again so I'll know who was in it. Group one was Mike Craig, Oleg, Santi. Who? What'd y'all get? Give me one.
The Jeroboam fortified Shechem.
Good. In fact, that was the first capital of the Northern Kingdom when he broke away. Later moved to the city of Samaria. But, yeah, good. Another one. Group two, that would be, I guess, Danny and Sewell and Teresa. What else you got? The second one.
That's when they came in and conquered the land. They headed, as soon as they could, they headed north there and renewed the covenant.
Right. And everybody probably knows this, but what two mountains are just surrounded on either side, forming almost like an acoustic bowl? You should know that.
Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim.
Yes, right, exactly. Mounts of blessings and cursings. Okay, how about David, your group? What you got? Or Paula, or you got?
Well, there was the unpleasantness between the men of Shechem and Jacob and Simeon and Levi and Dinah.
In fact, that very event was why Levi and Simeon were not given
territory.
Land, right?
Yeah.
Because those two brothers, I guess brothers of Dinah, full brothers, defended her honor in a kind of an unpleasant way, made Jacob odious to the men of the area. We'll visit that. And okay, about group four, you got another one?
The bones of Joseph were buried there.
Good. That's good. And why were they buried there? Why would – because, you know, he died.
He commanded them not to leave his bones in Egypt, but take them up from there.
But why there? Why did they take it all the way to Shechem?
That was the plot of land that Jacob had bought.
Great. Yeah, perfect. From
Shechem, right?
Yeah, from Shechem, or maybe probably his dad, whose name was what? What was his name? Okay, never mind. I'll share the screen. We're wasting the. I don't know. I don't know if you enjoy that kind of thing or not, but it's amazing how much you can find out, you know, in a short time. And you wonder why. You know, what is Shechem? I've heard that name before. Here are a few things about it. Abraham visited maybe one of his first stops before he headed south in his tour of the new promised land, Genesis 12. Later. Jacob bought the land there from Hamor, Shechem's father. Shechem was the guy that fell in love with Dinah, and his dad's name was Hamor. And then in chapter 34, while Jacob was there with his family, the sons of Jacob, Israel's, is when the incident with Dinah occurred. But I want you to look carefully at this language from Genesis 34. So what happened was his son, Shechem, fell in love with Dinah, and I don't know if she consented or not, but in any case, in the assessment of her brothers, she was defiled. And so, Shechem went to his dad and said, I really want to marry her. And you read this text right here. It says, the soul of my son, Shechem, longs for your daughter. I pray, give her to him for wife. Now, does this language sound familiar? And make marriages with us and give your daughters to us and take our daughters unto you. Does that sound familiar? isn't that, and that's essentially covenant making, right? And it's not only that, but dwell among us and trade with us and buy land and sell land with us. You see what Hamor is asking. Now, what religion do you think Hamor was?
Canaanite pagan religion.
He was a Canaanite or an Amorite or whatever he was, and definitely a pagan. And so you see in the earliest incident here in Shechem, there was this contrast or an attempt to make a covenant. Now, it didn't turn out that way, of course, because of the, you know, the vengeance that the guys took on him. But interesting that it began with this attempt to make a covenant by means of intermarriage. Interesting to me that that comes back as a kind of a key element in the book of Judges. And maybe why the temple there in Shechem is called Baal Berith, maybe. I don't know. Baal of the Covenants, potentially. Think about it. We'll think some more about it. Anyway, it is in Ephraim. Once the land was divided, it's listed as a border city, the southern border of Manasseh. It also was a city of refuge, along with Hebron, which we talked about earlier, and its significance, the other tomb of the patriarchs. It's the site of the blessings and cursing ceremony that Moses commanded in Deuteronomy 27, and Joshua obeyed in Joshua 8. It's the site of the covenant renewal at the end of Joshua's life. I think I heard somebody saying that. That's where Joshua said, "And as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." That took place there after, and there was a memorial stone set up there, Joshua 24. And then we're going to read about Abimelech's exploits. And then it was also Rehoboam's first capital. Somebody mentioned that. He fortified it. And it's probably close to where Jesus had his interaction with the Samaritan woman, because it mentions in that text the well, and that was all part of that area. So I'll put a kind of an expanded version of it here. So you see Ebal and Gerizim on either side, Jacob's well, and then the city of Sychar, which is mentioned in that story of Jesus in John chapter 4. If I worked real hard, I'd make some kind of an image or antitype or something out of that. I'm not going to do that, but it is interesting. So much happened even in the New Testament related to that. And so here it is up here. There it is right here with, I think, exaggerated distances there. This is a photoshopped picture of Gerizim and Ebal in the city. Nablus is the new name of the town here, but you see this bowl here in the acoustics here. We're going to see that Jotham climbs up on the mountain over here, and he shouts down during the coronation ceremony for Abimelech and tells the parable of the nation of trees, right? So let's look at how Abimelech does this. Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal. Now, do you notice what Gideon is going to be called throughout this whole story? I wonder why the emphasis on this "let Baal contend" shows up more prominently in this part of the narrative and not in the story of the battle. He went to Shechem to his mother's brothers. Okay, remember his mother was the concubine from Shechem, and spoke with them, with all the family of the house of his mother's father, saying, "Please speak in the hearing of the men of Shechem, which is better for you, that 70 sons of Jerubbaal reign over you, or that one reign over you? Remember that I am your own flesh and bone." Okay, so he's kind of setting himself up as the relative in contrast to this other family of brothers that are not related to them. That's up in Ophrah and also in Manasseh, and also the son of "Let Baal contend." His mother's brothers spoke all these words concerning him in the hearing of all the men of Shechem. And their heart was inclined to follow Abimelech, for they said, "He is our brother." So there's this family thing. And he, by the way, I'll just stop and say, so here's a case where, Abimelech is the son of a concubine. When we get to Jephthah, notice Jephthah is not the son of a concubine, but he has brothers, but he's the son of a harlot, different, very different. And we'll see that progression as well. They gave him 70 shekels of silver from the temple of Baal Berith, and there's our word, the Baal of the Covenant, with which he hired worthless fellows and reckless men, and they followed him. And he went to his father's house at Ophrah, killed his brothers, the 70 sons of Jerubbaal, on one stone. Notice later that Abimelech will die by one stone. That's an interesting closure to the story. By the way, Eric Borlaug called me up today specially to tell me that, just so you know. Anyway, but Jotham, the youngest son of Jerubbaal, was left because he hid himself, and all the men of Shechem gathered together all of Beth Millo, and they went and made Abimelech king beside the terebinth at the pillar of Shechem. Now, when they told Jotham, he went and stood on top of Mount Gerizim, lifted his voice and cried out, "Listen to me, you men of Shechem, that God may listen to you." And I'm not going to read the poem, but I want to note some of the seeds of division that Abimelech exploited. Number one, it was the son of Gideon's wives versus the son of a concubine, but the brothers of those who lived in Shechem. I mean, the concubine had brothers in Shechem. And also, Ophrah was Manasseh, a different tribe, whereas this was Shechem of Ephraim. And remember, Ephraim is not easy to get along with, and perhaps jealous, perhaps even jealous of the exploits of Gideon. Notice, too, there's an altar of Jehovah, as it's called, in chapter 8, verse 27, with the magic ephod there, versus the temple of Baal-berith, which you'll find that they later go and hide in, and it's part of their drunken ceremony as well later, too. And so he tells this story about the trees, olive tree, fig tree, vine tree. They all reject the kingship, which is similar to what Gideon had done. But the bramble, and by the way, if olive trees make oil and figs have sweetness and grapes make wine that cheers both God and man, he says, then what does a bramble do?
Kindling, basically.
That's a bit. It's really best at starting fires. So he just tells the story. He says, "Look, I'll be it, but if you don't like what's going on, then I'm just going to light my fire because that's what I do. That's what I'm good at." So he will do that. And I think I feel like I should find a way to shorten it, but then I would miss some of the main points. Anyway, I think Jotham challenges these men's integrity. Doesn't matter. He said, "Therefore, if you have acted in truth and sincerity in making Abimelech king, if you have dealt well with Jerubbaal and his house and have done to him as he deserved, for my father fought for you, he risked his life, he delivered you out of the hand of Midian, but you have risen up against my father's house this day and killed his 70 sons on one stone and made Abimelech the son of his female servant king over the men of Shechem because he is your brother. If then you have acted in truth and sincerity with Jerubbaal and with his house this day, then rejoice in Abimelech. Let him also rejoice in you. But if not," which of course they hadn't. You see, it's almost pitiful how he's just poking them in the eye with these questions, rhetorical questions. "But if not, let fire come and devour the men of Shechem and Beth Millo, and let fire come from the men of Shechem and from Beth Millo and devour Abimelech." Now, I don't think Jotham was inspired, but what he just said pretty much come to pass. I mean, first Abimelech destroyed them, and then he was destroyed with part of his rule there. Jotham ran away and he went. Has anybody figured out why Jerubbaal now becomes the dominant name of Gideon in this part of the story? Any ideas?
Well, it seems like they had a temple. Go ahead, Danny.
Well, I mean, Shechem, there was Baal worship going on there.
Right. Yeah, and I think that's kind of another poke in the eye. So, you know, it's kind of like, guess what? Baal never did contend, right? It never did work out. And so to some extent, it's just like a further conflict to say, you know, there's this probably, you know, not correct, but there's this worship of Yahweh up there in Ophrah, and that's where the hero lived, and that's where the guy who saved you lived, and Baal never did do anything about it, and here you are, Baal worshippers. Baal-berith is kind of their central meeting. And so I think that's maybe the reason that name is used quite a bit. And you can just see the tension that's created by that and the other details of the story. Okay. And then after Abimelech had reigned, and by the way, that word reigned is only found this one time in this usage. And the word is a very violent word, and it maybe means more like vanquished, or threw him out or something. It's a pretty, a very harsh word. But he reigned over Israel 3 years, and God sent a spirit. Hey, there it is. Is that the spirit we've been looking for? The spirit of God came upon him? Well, not quite. It's actually the opposite of that, the spirit that came upon Gideon, of ill will between Abimelech and the men of Shechem. Imagine that. that they had some ill will toward each other, right? And so I'll skip over a lot of this. Apparently, the men of Shechem then just set up ambushes, and they would just rob people that came through. And there was this fellow, Gael, and he became kind of the captain of Shechem, I guess on Abimelech's behalf. And they had a drunken party. They gathered the grapes from their vineyard, right? And they went into the house of their God, and I think that's that Baal Berith place, the temple of that. They ate and drank, and they cursed Abimelech, right? Easy to do because he wasn't there. And so, I'm sorry, I had this backwards. Gael, who was the bragger, and he said, who's Abimelech? Who's Shechem that we should serve him? And is he not the son of, there it is again, let Baal contend, is not Zebul, that's his officer. Now, notice this language. We've never seen this name in the whole story. Why in the world would he bring up Hamor? Remember who Hamor is? He's the father of Shechem from way back in the first story in Genesis, right? Well, the story of Jacob. Why is he, it's almost like he's saying, forget Shechem, remember Hamor. Why would he say that? So that's probably the right answer. I don't know for sure either. But I think he's kind of saying, don't forget our religious roots here, right? Remember Shechem got himself in trouble, wanting to fall in love with these people. But Hamor